Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
You've got questions? O'Reilly Auto Parts has answers. Need a pro you can trust? We've got that too. No matter what you need, our professional parts people have the training and expertise to help you do things right. Deep automotive knowledge. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Dress, the History of Fashion is a production of Dressed Media. With over 8 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dressed, the History of Fashion, a podcast where we explore the who, what, when of why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts, April Callahan
and Cassidy Zachary. Welcome, dress listeners, to part two of our Dress Fashion History Tour of Paris recap. On Wednesday, we only got through half of our jam-packed fashion textile history week. And actually, not even half, April. We barely got to day three, and we didn't finish day three.
I was going to say, we didn't even get halfway through. This was such an incredibly special trip, and we are particularly excited about this year's recaps because it is the very first time that we are incorporating some of the voices of our attendees. And they sent us little clips and shared with us some of their favorite parts of the trip, things that made it very special to them. And we're going to hear lots more of those at the end of today's recap. But where did we leave off? We left off partway through day three.
After our lovely morning spent with Rebecca Devaney, going through Paris's oldest haberdasheries and notion shops. But that was just one part of our day.
Yes, because then we headed over to the Museum of Perfume in Paris, which is operated by the French fragrance and I guess we would say beauty brand in general, Fragonard. And if some of you are not familiar with Fragonard, it is because they do not advertise, which I think is a baller move. That is so amazing that you're so good that you don't even have to advertise. And they do not have any retail outlets outside of France, which is also pretty great. But just a little bit history of the company. It was founded in Grasse in France in 1926. They opened their first boutique in Paris 10 years later in 1936. And currently, the company is being run by the founder's great granddaughters. And Fragonard is a major player in the French perfume industry. And I just love the fact that this is keeping in theme, Cass, of part one. We kept talking about we were going to a lot of these ateliers and these businesses, visiting them, and they were on their fifth generation ownership. That is so quintessentially French, and Fragonard is very much in the same vein. So after our travelers had a little bit of a private tour of the Musée de Parfum, there is also at the very end a private shopping experience, and everybody goes crazy about this. I'm going to let you tap in here and let you talk about some of your favorite parts about this.
Yeah, it is a really special experience. And we do have to give a shout out to the museum because it's actually from last year, newly reopened and renovated. So whereas last year we were upstairs and they're very brightly lit galleries, now they have moved their museum into this multi-storied basement, essentially, which might not immediately sound appealing, but it is so
very cool.
You descend into this experience, which takes you through the entire process of perfume making. So you have a guide, and also something to note, this is entirely free. So I don't know if you can just walk in off the street and book a tour.
I don't know if you can.
Yeah, you can definitely do it online. And so you go on this tour, depending on who your tour guide is, I would say probably it's about 15 to 30 minutes, but it takes you through the entire process. And there's historic videos documenting the process of perfume making. And then my favorite part of the tour is when they take us to the history of the perfume bottle. So you see the progression of the perfume bottle over time, and they have really old examples, and they're such beautiful little art vessels in and of themselves. And that is my favorite part.
Yeah. And some of these vessels that held perfumes date back to, we're talking antiquity.
Yes.
And not even necessarily liquid perfumes, but back when perfumes were balms and all these various like incarnations of scent. And then, of course, in that particular section that you're just talking about, there are many fragrance bottles by couture houses as well. We saw some Schiaparelli, House of Worth, you name it. They're all in there. And also, we've mentioned that you get to go do this little private shopping thing. That was so surprising at the end. They didn't take us into the boutique like they did last time. And you still have your guide with you when we were there last year to help you shop. But this time, it is a private shopping experience for the people at the museum only. No one else can come in, which is really cool. I loved it. I'm now also officially obsessed with their clear soaps.
Yes, I was going to say I bought soap for the first time too. So what's really cool is then your guide who is taking you through the museum is now your guide in teaching you how to buy and use perfume and really educating consumers, especially Americans who aren't necessarily immersed in perfume culture. Many of us wear it, but we really don't know where it comes from. And in France, it's really an art form that they've cultivated over hundreds of years, like many things in France.
To it.
Yes.
Whole etiquette to it.
And a lot of people don't know, for instance, that there's a difference between, say, eau de parfum and perfume. So a lot of what we wear in the U.S. is eau de parfum.
But or it's eau de toilette.
Or eau de toilette. Yeah, there's all these different distinctions. And I think it's based on
the scent-based ingredients. Parfum is going to have the highest concentration of the very special scent. And obviously, a lot of this is in a suspension. So the cheaper prices are going to have less of the very special set ingredients. And as you go up into the more expensive ranges, it's going to have more, which also means it has more staying power. And at Fragonard, they say that their parfum will stay on your body and be active for 24 hours, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's like the concentration of the fragrance or the oils that capture the fragrance. And so most of us are actually using eau de parfum. Very rarely are we using real perfume. So you learn about this when you go there. And then you get to try, I think usually they have about 12 scents. You don't try all of them. But what your guide will do is they'll spray it. They'll let you smell it. They'll tell you about the notes and the fragrances. And something that is an option there as well, which we didn't do it this year, but last year we did a perfume making class. So if that interests you too, you can do that. So you can really probably spend half a day there. We always have so much fun.
Yeah. And last year I learned that I'm very bad at making my own perfume. So
I did as well, which is probably why we didn't do it again this year. Personal preference. And then that was not the end of our day because we actually, a few of us went home, but most of us went to Crazy Horse.
And if you are a longtime listener, you already know what's coming. It's once again one of April's favorite Paris experiences.
Yeah, and we always have so much fun. It's a tastefully nude cabaret. That's always a highlight of the tour. And actually, this year, I wanted to read you something from their website a little bit more about the fashion history of the house, which is so wonderful. And so the website tells us that it all began in the 50s. So Crazy Horse started in 1951. And when it opened its doors, its neighbors were Yves Saint Laurent, Hubert de Givenchy, and Cristobal Balenciaga. Not what I was expecting, I must say.
Literally, when Crazy Horse opened in 1951, they were the next door neighbor of the Balenciaga couture house. We're mentioning this to you guys. Obviously, it's a wonderful fashion reference, but we're just positioning it in terms of what this place was envisioned to be when it was founded, right? It's very elite. It's very special. It's very, I don't know, how do you describe it? It's a luxury experience if you're going to go to Paris and see a cabaret.
Yes, and it's also just so much fun. You can get an option where you can split a bottle of champagne. You can get an option where you can eat. But I just also just love this new fashion history connection that we're just discovering. And the website also tells us that Balenciaga, who was located right next door, feared that his high society clients would not appreciate the decorations done in the purest saloon spirit, which Elaine Bernardine had installed outside. And Elaine is the founder of Crazy Horse. And so he received a concession from Elaine, and he agreed to limit these installations for Balenciaga in exchange for Balenciaga dressing the dancers.
Yes. Such a long history in Paris between Crazy Horse and fashion. Christian Louboutin does all their shoes. And in the cabaret itself, before the show starts, and the space is actually quite intimate, more intimate than you would expect. To the left and to the right of the stage are these plaques of past very special clients that they've had and a ton of fashion designers. And there's even a little section about fashion designers who have dressed the Crazy Horse dancers. And it's a who's who of all of the things.
Paco Rabanne, Karl Lagerfeld.
And of course, we have interviewed Crazy Horse's very first not Crazy Horse girl special guest, Ms. Dita Von Teese. And we talk about it in that episode. So if you want to learn more about Dita's time at Crazy Horse, you can return to the past ep.
Absolutely. Oh, and also just a insider tip, if you do go to Crazy Horse in the evening, when you exit, if you go to the earlier show, I think we went to the 8 p.m., if you exit, the Eiffel Tower, there is a fantastic view of the Eiffel Tower, which is just down the street. You walk to that view, and at 10 o'clock on the dot, the Eiffel Tower sparkles. So that's how we concluded that evening, which was really magical. And then we all had to turn around and get up the next morning for day four.
Now we're only halfway through.
Yeah. But actually, the next day was really special, April, because this is a dressed first. Again, something, this is our fifth time doing this tour. We'd never done this before. We got a private tour of the Yves Saint Laurent Museum, which was really cool.
Yes. We were up bright and early because the private tours are not just private tours, but it's before they open.
Yes.
So it's extra private. And because our group is a little bit larger, and once again, we had to split into two groups. So you had one tour guide. Our tour guide, Emmanuel, was amazing. She also gives tours of the Palais Galliera, which we're going to talk about next. But Cass, do you want to talk about the exhibition itself that we saw?
Yeah. And again, just a shout out to Mathieu. So Mathieu and Emmanuel, I can't remember the name of the tour company that they came from, but they were both fashion historians, which was really important. And so Mathieu took us through this exhibition and gave us such incredible insights into what we were seeing. So the current exhibition, and this is the Yves Saint Laurent Museum. So it is, again, just like the Azzedine Alaïa, it is a museum or foundation. It is dedicated exclusively to the famed French haute couturier Yves Saint Laurent. And they have rotating exhibitions because they have a fabulous archive of his work. And this current exhibition is called The Flowers of Yves Saint Laurent, and it's curated by Olivier Saillard and Gaël Mamin. And it actually is a joint exhibition in collaboration with the Yves Saint Laurent Museum in Marrakech, Morocco, which is super fascinating, April. I think you'll know a little bit more about the history of that museum.
Yes. So many years ago, I visited Morocco and was lucky enough to visit Jardin Majorel, which were the gardens outside of Yves Saint Laurent and Pierre Bourget's home in Morocco. And Yves Saint Laurent grew up in Algeria, but when he and Pierre Bourget visited Morocco, they fell in love. And so they bought this beautiful home and they did it all up and they spent a ton of time out there. And so when I was there, the house itself was not open to the public, but the gardens themselves are, and they're wonderful to visit. But since then, the Musée Yves Saint Laurent Marrakech has opened. And I am still unclear if the museum is located in their former home or not.
It's
maybe
nearby.
Someone can educate me. It's around in the proximity. It's adjacent, let's just say.
Yeah, but so it's so cool. So if you happen to be in Marrakech, Morocco, you can also check out a version of the exhibition that's on view in Paris. And April mentioned Pierre Bourget, who was Yves Saint Laurent's partner in both life and love. And they lived their daily lives, and I'm quoting the exhibition text here, surrounded by flowers and gardens in their apartments, their secondary homes, one of which April just mentioned, and at their fashion house. And passionate about flowers, the couturier found them to be an infinite source of inspiration. And Yves Saint Laurent shared his admiration for nature with many artists and writers, in particular with one of his favorite authors, Proust, as he revealed in the magazine L'Egoiste in 1987. A Proustian universe appears in the designer's interiors as well as during his runway shows, and the writer would describe women as flowers, whereas the couturier would pay homage to them by covering them with blossoms. And there's over 30 garments and drawings in this exhibition, and that really highlights this symbiosis between nature, literature, and the work of Yves Saint Laurent. And I, again, just like the Azzedine and Alaïa show, this was one of the best exhibitions I've seen at this museum because so many of the pieces were the supreme example of not just Yves Saint Laurent's talent, but the talent of his ateliers, the hand embroidery on some of these pieces. It was just remarkable and so stunning.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And again, Cass and I have done this tour for our travelers so many times, and we get excited again and again going because we get to see new things too. And actually, we actually had two travelers on this year's trip that came to last year's Paris tour.
Yeah.
Just saying, guys, this is what we're out here doing with you all. One of the things that I especially enjoyed at this time at the museum was being with Emmanuelle, who was our guide. And again, like you said, she's a fashion historian, was actually at the very beginning of the tour. She took us around some of the photographs and documents and sketches, some of more of the fashion ephemera before we got to the garments themselves, and explained things that I didn't even know. I learned a lot on that tour. So thank you, Mathieu and Emmanuelle. We will be back.
Yeah. Something always new.
Well, something again, once again, new Palais Galliera, yes. The Fashion Museum of Paris was our next stop. It is literally, what, a 3-minute walk around the corner?
Yes.
So just a pro tip, guys, if you are going to either Palais Galliera or YSL Museum.
Or Dior.
Yeah. Everything is super, super close. The Palais Galliera, again, the Fashion Museum of the City of Paris, it is, if not the most important fashion collection in the world, it's one of them. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say it's the most important fashion collection in the world. They have something like nearly like 500,000 pieces, which is wild. And it really is this compendium of fashion history, not only French, from the 18th century until today. So we saw a couple of different exhibitions when we were there with our travelers. We saw part two of their exhibition, Mode en Mouvement, which is fashion in motion. And we saw part one of it last year, right? So this was a longer fashion exhibition that they had mounted around the time of the Olympics, because obviously sport has been such a big subject here in Paris. Cass, do you want to mention a couple things that you loved so much about part two of the Fashion in Motion exhibition?
Yeah, and I just want to say too that Sue and Ania, two of our travelers this year, were also in my What Women Wore to the Revolution class. And so it was really cool to see this exhibition, because this exhibition follows the same timeline as that class that I teach, which is about the evolution and revolution of women's fashion from the 1850s to my class into the 1960s. So this exhibition was seeing all of that told through garments. Of course, this one starts actually in the 18th century, but it's all about the relationship between clothing and the body and women's bodies.
And movement.
Yeah. And of course, as women gain access to more movement and more comfortable clothes into the 20th century. And there's so many cool pieces in that exhibition. Yeah. I don't even know where to start. One of my favorite pieces and surprising pieces that someone had to point out to me because I didn't notice, and actually it was an example of menswear that was featured in it, one of the few pieces of menswear, was the heat-generated aviator suit. Did you see that? That you would plug in the 1940s?
So it's like an electric blanket.
Yes, for your body.
For you, yes. When you were flying your plane.
Not entirely sure how it worked. And it scares me a little bit.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think I want to know.
But that was one of the more bizarre pieces for sure.
Okay, one that is definitely a lot more traditional. But when I saw it, I'll explain. So it was a golf cape from 1898. And I have to say, in the 1880s, 1890s, bicycling is definitely taking off for women as sport. Women were engaging with gymnastics and tennis a little bit. But golf? You don't necessarily see it referenced in the fashion history record that much. So it was very surprising to see this golf cape from 1898. It was gray, very thick wool. It had a hood. And then it had this little crossbody bag that was meant to put your golf balls and your tees in. And it had buttons on it. And the buttons had like golf motifs of golf balls and clubs and like a laurel wreath. What is so interesting about it is that little crossbody bag, and then the lining, the inside of the cape itself, was this like purpley and gray plaid. And so what you have, and it's short, right? It's not all the way to the ground like women's hemlines would have been at that time. So everyone's saying it's coming to your low hip. It looks so 1940s. I saw it and I was like, oh, this is 1940s. And I looked at the label and my jaw dropped. It was 1898. It looks so American look. It looks so Bonnie Cashin.
It's so chic.
I'm just saying, yeah. The language of design over time sometimes will really surprise you.
And something else to say about that exhibition that's really cool is it shows you, and we just re-aired our sporting fashion episodes last week, but what I really appreciate about the exhibition, it shows you what women would have worn to do all of these different activities. So you have what women would have worn driving at the dawn of the 20th century when motor vehicles were completely exposed to the elements and you have to wear goggles and headgear and fully lined coats, giant fur coats, golfing, as you mentioned, biking, walking, swimming, riding horses, and then playing tennis, I thought was also really cool. And then one of my favorite pieces was the fencing ensemble.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
because
yeah.
That's those not something really cool. You necessarily associate with women, but they were doing mm-hmm. it.
And so as a side exhibition, that's a little bit around the corner. It's more of a specialty tangent of this Fashion on Motion exhibition is an exhibition on resort wear, which was beautiful. And I took so, so many photos in this one.
Yeah. And dress listeners, you can expect a reel because I actually took the time to walk through that entire thing and film because it's a really cool exhibition space. It reminds me of the History Gallery at FIT and that it always provides kind of a chronological survey of whatever the theme is. And this was resort wear, so a lot of swimwear. And it does it in chronological order, but it's this long curved hallway. And so you just walk along and see literally the evolution of what I focused on was swimwear. But there's certainly different elements of women's resort wear as well, including something that I think you want to mention that I had never seen in person.
Are we talking about the canvas beach boots? Because that's what I want to talk about.
No, I was talking about the first bikini, but yes, go ahead.
Well, I have that on my notes to talk about too. But even before that, and even older, predating the very first bikini, we're going to get to that in a second. But they had this pair of like 19th century canvas beach boots, which were essentially
yes,
little
those were cool.
Like slippers made out of like linen, canvas, duck. I don't know. Maybe they were treated with some sort of oil to make them. Who knows? They were dark ivy. They lace up the front like ballerina slippers with bright blood red ribbons. But the coolest thing is that one of them was turned over so you could see on the bottom that they were entirely ergonomically to support your foot lined with some sort of gold metal that had holes in it. So these were protecting your feet in the water by metal bottoms that had holes to let the water go through. But they're the sweetest, most like a sentimental kind of, I don't know. I would literally wear those today. They're badass. Not in the water. I'm just saying like out in public.
Yeah.
No heels. They're just flat on your feet. Okay. Bringing us to the world's first bikini. Casco.
I just wasn't expecting it. And if you've heard years ago, I did a two-part history of the swimsuit episode, and we talk about this and go a lot more in depth if you want to know more. But prior to the 1940s, there had been women's swimwear had evolved pretty quickly. When you're looking at what women are wearing at the dawn of the 20th century, which is essentially being covered head to toe. And then by the 30s, women are wearing two-piece swimwear. You can see their abdomen, but you can't see their belly button. And so the bikini is defined as the itty bitty teeny weeny bikini. Actually, I think it's Louis Rerard who stakes claim to the bikini. He's the one who gave the bikini its name. You could essentially pull the swimsuit through a ring, maybe an inch in diameter. That's how little fabric it was. And you talked about this recently, how it was so incredibly shocking. No one wanted to model it. So he had to hire a stripper or a sex worker to do it.
I think she was a sex worker. Yeah. No one wanted to be photographed in it because it was so scandalous.
Yes. So scandalous for the 1940s. But on display in this exhibition is a bikini from Jacques Haim's spring 1946 collection. And months later, Louis would debut his bikini. But yeah, super scandalous for the 1940s and such an iconic garment to be able to see one of the world's first in person.
Yeah. And I think there's a little bit of a fashion history myth that Louis Rayard's bikini was the first bikini. But in actuality, we know for a fact that Jacques Haim's bikini, he called it Atom. So Adam, he also branded
World War
it as
II
the world's
era.
world's smallest bathing suit. So it was a little bit of a double entendre that the atom's a small particle, but then also there was all this talk about the atom bomb that was happening.
Yeah.
Which is why Louis named his the bikini, because they were testing the atom bomb in the Bikini Islands. Oh my God, how did this turn into this weird history of colonialism? But it really did. Fashion and politics. We cannot separate them, friends.
Yeah. And just real quick, I did, as if you want to learn more about this, because it is very fascinating. Again, I did that episode and it's a deep dive. But again, this exhibition will, if you listen to those podcast episodes, then go see this exhibit, you will not be disappointed.
Cass and I were like, wait, what? This is here? This Jockheim version is here? So anyway, I had another, oh my God, I can't believe this just happened moment. When I saw the Madame Gray Haute Couture beach ensembles.
Yes.
Cast. I'm not going to lie, I got a little misty-eyed. They're so beautiful. It's these little beach dresses that are super, super short. They're from the 1960s. And then they have shorts underneath. But they also have like cutouts in the back. They're linen and silk taffeta. And we can't not post these on our Instagram at some point this week because they're really wonderful.
Yes, there will definitely be multiple reels coming your way, including one on this exhibition in particular.
And I just want to say, I was fortunate enough to be able to go see the opening of a brand new exhibition that was not on view at the time that our tour happened. But Stephen Jones, the legendary milliner, has an amazing retrospective up right now at the Palais Galliera. It's a retrospective of his hats from the 1980s until today. And the opening was insanely crowded. I ran into a ton of people that I knew. And so I will be returning this week to go back and read actually all the exhibition labels and see all the hats that I couldn't get a good view of at the opening. But that's another one not to be missed. Paris Rec.
Yes. And I actually had the honor of interviewing Stephen Jones. Gosh, I want to say it was last year, but it was probably 2 years ago. So if you want to listen to our Stephen Jones podcast interview, that was really special. And something that was also very special for our guests is that Stephen walked by us while we were there.
Yeah. We're at the Palais Galliera. His exhibition was opening in 2 weeks and he walked by and I said hello to him. I introduced him to all of our travelers and then he went on to his lunch because he had a very busy day.
Dress listeners, it goes without saying that a lot of our shopping errands are made easier these days by shopping online. So why aren't you using Rakuten? Rakuten is the smartest way to save money when you shop.
That's right. You can earn cash back when you shop at 3,500 stores for fashion, beauty, electronics, home essentials, travel, dining, concert tickets, and more. How does it work, you ask? Well, brands pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and this is passed along to you as cash back.
From Sephora to Petco and Levi's to Expedia, when you shop with Rakuten, your cash back can be deposited directly into your PayPal account, or they will send you a check. Membership is free, and you can even maximize your savings by stacking cash back on top of other deals like store sales and coupons.
If you're already shopping at your favorite stores, why not save while you're doing it? Get the Rakuten app now and join the 17 million users who are already saving. Cashback rates change daily. See Rakuten.com for details. That's Rakuten. Your cashback really adds up. Us ladies have all been there. Feeling a smidge off the days before your cycle is something that we have all experienced at one point or another. For some of us, it's occasional. For others, it's a monthly battle.
Which is why Happy Mammoth has created Estro Control, a capsule containing science-backed herbal extracts that help support hormonal health, especially in women who suffer from PMS.
The way Estro Control eases PMS is quite interesting. The ingredients help support the liver, and that's where our hormones get processed, especially estrogen. So when the estrogen isn't processed well in the liver, this can potentially trigger PMS.
Estro Control is made specifically for women who are premenopausal, so it's perfect for women that haven't entered menopause yet. In fact, it's amazing for perimenopause, when hormones start to fluctuate and PMS can hit hard.
For a limited time, you can get 15% off on your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code DRESSED at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code DRESSED for 15% off today.
We are not done because then we took our guests to the storied Parisian opera house, the Palais Garnier, for a behind-the-scenes tour, which is always just such a treat. We did this for the first time last year. This is one of the most famous and beautiful opera houses in the world. And actually, it comes with a really fascinating history, April, which I actually didn't know this. Quote, on the 14th of January, 1858, a new assassination attempt was carried out in front of the Le Peltier Theater against Emperor Napoleon III and his wife, Empress Eugenie. This failed attack, which was organized by Italian revolutionaries, put a definite end to that venue. And so in 1860, apparently they organized this international competition to design this next opera house. And there was 171 projects submitted, but it was a 35-year-old and then unknown architect by the name of Charles Garnier who was selected and won this distinctive honor. And it took 15 years to create the opera, and it was inaugurated on January 5th, 1875. It becomes one of the major hubs and places to see and be seen in Paris. We always love to start there on a Rue de la Paix tour because the Rue de la Paix, which is one of the most luxurious fashion streets in the world in the 19th and early 20th centuries, is right next door. It's right across the street. And so people would go get their haute couture creations, and then they would wear it along with their jewels from Cartier, which is also right there, to the opera. Such an incredibly beautiful place. It's majestic inside. And famously, for our fan of the opera lovers, it is the setting for Gaston Leroux's 1910 novel, The Phantom of the Opera. And we get to do this behind the scenes tour. And what's really cool is that we even get to go down to the storied lake that is part of that book, famously. But the really special part and why we do this tour on a fashion history tour is because we do get to go see the costume workshops for the ballet and get to go in there and see the tutus hanging upside down. They're stored in one of the most historic rooms in there that's actually preserved.
It's something like a national landmark. You want that one room within the opera house.
Because it's all wood and it's been preserved in its original state. It's two stories. So again, just one of those things that you have to really experience and one of those exclusive offerings that we bring to people on our tour.
Yeah, and apparently this year, ultra exclusive, because when we went to bring everyone into the private tour entrance, they had a sign up on the gate saying the opera is closed, there are no tours, and we're like, what? Wait, what? What's happening? And the guard wouldn't let us in. Cass pulls out our phone and calls our tour guide, and she was the only one standing behind the closed gate.
Yeah, Sophie, who was Sophie. Fabulous.
No one else, just her. She's, oh no, these are my people. And then she escorts them into the opera house. And the reason why the sign was up is because that they were actually having an opera that night. Yeah, when we say behind the scenes, they were getting ready. The dancers were getting ready. You get to partake in all of this. It's lovely.
But are we done, dress listeners? We are done with that day. But the next day is arguably one of our most anticipated days that everyone really is familiar with and looking forward to, and that is our day at the Palace of Versailles.
Because no fashion history trip to Paris would be complete without going to Versailles, but most importantly for our tour, Marie Antoinette's private escape from court life, Petit Trianon. And so how we get to Versailles is also very lovely. We take a private coach. They whisk us away during that about, what, like 30, 35-minute trip. Cass and I do a lecture about the role of fashion at the French court. And then everyone goes to a visit to the main palace with audio guides. This year, we actually sat down in the main palace and had a very lovely group lunch.
Yeah, we all had lunch at Angelina's, which was really special. And something that was also very special is that they had an exhibition up that was dedicated to horses and horsemanship and the history of it at Versailles. And because I believe that they had the dressage competition for the Olympics at Versailles. So they created this wonderful exhibition, which was so cool because it was throughout the Versailles Palace. So normally these statues and giant full armored horses are not typically in the rooms.
And paintings.
Yes.
That one very famous painting of Napoleon.
Yes, on his white horse.
Yeah. Where it's like rearing up. Yeah, yes. It's larger than life. We got to see that in person.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if it's still up, but if it is, definitely check it out. Because one of my favorite parts was learning about what many of the women horse riders, and there was all these wonderful photographs, and again, I'll probably post a reel about this, of women riding side saddle and doing these amazing feats. It was like, it had to have been a sports competition or a display, in their corsets, in their long skirts, side saddle, feet in the air on these horses. So lots of fashion history in there as well. So definitely check that out. And then we headed back to arguably our favorite part of this day, which most people don't know about or have time to get to, but we always make a point, and that is heading to Marie Antoinette's Petit Trianon in Hamlet.
And if you are going to Versailles, don't miss this part. It's only a 20-minute walk from the main palace, and that 20-minute walk takes you down the hill and through these amazing gardens. And really what you're going to understand when you reach Petit Trianon is the striking difference between this very, very in-your-face, forced opulence of the main palace of Versailles, and then also this also extremely luxurious refinement of Petit Trianon. So this is where Marie Antoinette went when she wanted to get from away from all the noise and kind of the gossip and kind of the scandal and all of this at the court. Petit Trianon is just as luxurious, but it's a different kind of luxury. It's softer, it's quieter, and it's more personal, I would say. How do you feel about it, Cass?
Yeah, it's so beautiful. And her home is really lovely in that you get to go. And this is something they don't offer at Versailles, which they should, which would be really cool. I always love at museums, especially historic homes, when they have upstairs, downstairs tours. Because yeah. I'm like, okay, historically, I would not have been royalty. I would have been working downstairs in the kitchen or laboring. And so it's really cool. You get to go into the kitchens. Something that was really cool that I never noticed before is that apparently Marie Antoinette had mirrors that she could put up in her room if she wanted more privacy, but they're on a pulley system and they go down into the basement. And so you got to see where they went down into. And I never had noticed that before. And then just in these kitchens, which are these huge cold rooms with gigantic fireplaces. So that was definitely always a highlight for me. And then, of course, walking another 20 minutes to the Hamlet, which is this majestic farm village she created.
Tapping back on that pulley system and things ascending and descending, I think that they had that whole system in the dining room too at Petit Trianon. So what they would do is when you walk into the museum itself, it just looks like a normal floor, but they had the ability to pull that section down and then set the table. And then the table would rise back up with everything perfect and all of the food on it.
Oh, that's super interesting.
This is so baller. I'm using this term again. Apparently, I'm very excited this episode.
Oh, and something that was new this year that I forgot to mention about Versailles is the sisters and the children's rooms were open for the first
time after
years of renovation. So that was really cool to see, because it's always just fun to imagine who lived there and where they lived.
Versailles never disappoints. As Cass said, if you're at Petit Trianon, go back into Marie Antoinette's playground, the Hamlet, which is her working farm where she played shepherdess. The animals were out a lot this year, yeah.
Yes, there were numerous horses and ponies. There was a very grumpy potbelly pig who was chasing the chickens around. It was really lovely, and it's just very calming back there and not what you would expect in the very crowded Versailles. And during the summer, you can take your own picnic. It's open to the public, not the Petit Trianon. You need a ticket to get in there, but the Grand Canals, which are outside of Petit Trianon, are open to the public. You can rent boats. You can picnic. All around lovely time.
Always a Paris fave.
So we spent the entire day there. We went back and then we started our next day with just one thing. We did our Rue de la Paix tour, which, as I mentioned earlier, is that famous luxury street where we take you down the street, which is just really a block, but so much fashion history there, including it was the home of Charles Frederick Worth, arguably the founding father of haute couture. He opened his first house there. Jean Paquin's there. Schiaparelli's there and is still there. And that's
Cartier. Still there.
Yes. So always such a highlight.
I just think this tour is always super fun because especially for those of you who have been listening to the podcast for a very long time and have heard us speaking about these fashion houses and these fashion brands and how they started, we will literally walk you down the street and tell you who did what, when, where, and, and who, what scandal happened where.
And didn't you just discover that there was a new fashion house on Rue de la Paix?
No, I just did not realize that apparently Bouet Sir was historically located between House of Worth and Cartier. And thank you, Valeria Dorogova, past dressed guest, and apparently my most frequent hangout partner here in Paris for... She's done a lot of work on Bouet Sir. She's, oh, yeah, Bouet Sir was right next to Worth. I'm like, wait, what? How did I not know that? Anyway, thank you, Valeria.
Yeah, and then we always end that tour at Schiaparelli, which when that brand was relaunched with Daniel Roseberry at the head, they made an effort to buy back that space of the original, not her original location, that was around the corner on the Rue de la Paix, but one of her locations where she moved in the 1930s. And that's the
same.
On
Place Vendôme.
Yes, on Place Vendôme. And people really enjoy this tour. And that included our fellow alumni, April, Marianne Brown, who also attended FIT's Fashion and Museum Studies Master Program. Not at the same time of us, but she is an alumni as well. And we'll hear from her now.
Hi, my name is Marianne Brown. I'm the retired archivist and collections manager at the Connie Nast Archive. I love the entire week. I especially enjoyed Monday's visit to Atelier Carico, where we learned about film and theater costumes. I enjoyed the textile tour with Rebecca Devaney. And lastly, Friday's walking tour of the Rue de la Paix, envisioning the couture houses of Worth, Cartier, and Doucet was really wonderful. Cassidy and April created an amazing week where the group learned all about fashions and textiles of Paris couture. I would totally recommend anyone taking this tour, and I would love to attend another one. Thank you, April and Cassidy.
So after our early morning Rue de la Paix tour, we gave our travelers the rest of the day off to investigate and indulge in all of the Paris experiences that they have been wanting to do and accumulating the whole week prior. But we ended with a goodbye dinner, and we ended it at one of Paris's most historic Art Nouveau restaurants, a brasserie. We ended it at Brasserie Moulard, and we did it in their private room. And Cass, we have been there with our travelers before, and the restaurant is exquisite. There are mirrors everywhere. There's Art Nouveau mosaics everywhere. The entire thing is amazing. But we had never been in that private back room, which the entire ceiling is glass. That is lit from, it's stained glass that's lit from above. And yeah, that was super special.
Yeah. And it's always a really special time because it's the last thing we do together as a group after having spent this entire week together, getting to know each other. And something we did for the first time this year is everyone went around the table and shared their favorite experiences from the trip. And it was really special to hear from everyone.
Yeah, and this was a little bit of a surprise to Cass and I because we didn't ask people to do this. It was actually something that...
Ania, I think, recommended. Yeah,
I think it was Ania started it. And she was like, here's what we're doing. And then everyone went around the table and it was... Yeah, that was very touching, you guys. So we've never done that before, but I think it is something that we should incorporate moving forward.
And it was so special that it inspired us to include people's voices here if they wanted to be included, because so many of them are our loyal listeners, that we wanted to give them the chance to share their experiences and be a part of Dress Podcast. Because really, Dress listeners, you are the reason we do what we do, and we couldn't do it without you, and we wouldn't want to do it without you.
No.
And regardless of if you are planning to join us in Paris, we are hopeful that in these remembrances, you have found inspiration and will continue to find inspiration, be it finding inspiration to finally take the leap and book your dream trip to Paris or whatever city you've always imagined visiting, or going to that city to find that inspiration from the art, fashion, and beauty that it has to offer. You won't regret it, and you can just take the word of some of this year's attendees. beginning with Andy.
Hello, my name is Andy, and I'm from Texas. I turned 50 this year, and the trip to Paris with Dressed was a way to celebrate that and welcome in a new season of my life. I was a stay-at-home mom for the last 23 years and have lived in the same part of Texas my entire life. This last year, we became empty nesters, moved to a new area, and opened some Airbnbs. With this new season and new opportunities, I've been on a journey of self-discovery. I stumbled upon the Dress podcast about a year ago, and while I knew nothing about fashion and had never taken an interest in it before, I was captivated. I was so nervous to come on this trip, but so thankful I took the leap and came. This trip was truly the most incredible and magical trip I've ever been on. I loved every single moment, from the curated tours and experiences to the people I met that have become some dear friends. This trip inspired me to take risk, believe in myself, and ignited new passions and interests in me to embrace this new season and to trust myself. I am forever grateful for this time. Thank you so much.
Hi, my name is Sammy. I'm from Philadelphia, and I'm a fashion designer and the founder of I Am Human, the brand, where we are raising mental health awareness through fashion. After nearly a decade working in corporate fast fashion, I found myself seeking renewed inspiration. That's when I joined Dressed, Trip to Paris, and Cassidy and April did not disappoint. They immersed us in fashion history and guided us through incredible experiences, including an unforgettable textile tour and visits to couture houses and museums. These moments reignited my passion for design and opened my eyes to new career possibilities within fashion, something I haven't felt since my days at Drexel studying fashion design. Seeing the meticulous hand craftsmanship firsthand, the attention to detail and meaning behind every stitch and design was truly inspiring. Exploring these iconic spaces, like the couture house behind the new look costumes and the opera house, reminded me why I fell in love with fashion in the first place. So a huge thank you to Cass and April for helping re-inspire me.
Hi, my name is Summer, and I'm a graduate student at FIT studying fashion textiles. My favorite part of the trip was getting to see everything I've learned over the past year come to life. It was so great getting to hear about everyone's interests, and it reignited some of my own. I even came away from the trip with the concept for my master's thesis. So thank you for an amazing trip.
My name is Sue. I've been following Dressed and Cassidy and April for at least 6 years, probably more. I've also been a student in their online classes they've been doing the last couple years. This year, I was fortunate to do their Paris week. It was everything I hoped for and more. Trip of a lifetime. Such a personal experience with Cassidy and April and our wonderful group of women. Highlights were the Garnier Opera House, the Christian Dior Museum, the Yves Saint Laurent Atelier, and Caraco. It was wonderful. I will forever remember it, and I hope to take more trips with them.
Hello, folks. I'm Julie from Austin. There were so many things about my trip to Paris that I enjoyed. Once-in-a-lifetime experiences, for sure. And I could talk your ears off about witnessing the wonder of Yves Saint Laurent's designs up close, or walking the same paths as Marie Antoinette in her gardens at Petit Trianon. But honestly, absolute favorite part of the trip was being there with April and Cassidy as experts to discuss what we're seeing right then and there, plus meeting the others on the tour who share my interest in fashion history and knowing more about the people who actually made the beautiful clothing and costumes I've admired from afar my whole life. I don't know anyone else who could deliver such a great Parisian adventure.
Hi, Cassidy and April. This is Ina from Ottawa, Canada. I have been a great fan of your podcast since the first episode and always dreamt of your Paris tour. I was lucky to take part in last year's New York tour, and after that, I just knew that Paris was a must. Visiting New York with you was amazing, but Paris was just a dream come true. I am a payroll manager and I'm not connected to fashion in any way in my professional life. But I sew and knit my own clothes, and I'm fascinated by textile, fashion history, and garment construction. Visiting museums, and especially real haute couture ateliers, and seeing when and how the magic happens, talking to people who touch exquisite fabrics and lace and bring amazing designs to life, that was an unforgettable experience. And of course, experiencing it all with you was so extraordinary because you share your knowledge and your passion so generously. Thank you so much for all you do. I'm looking forward to more dressed episodes and to new tours with you.
We said we weren't going to cry. I said in part one that I wasn't going to cry on the podcast. And now I'm crying in part two.
I know. Again, thank you guys so much. I think I always say this, but we record this in our bedrooms or our apartments in Paris, worlds away from each other and from all of our listeners. And to put it out into the world and for it to come back to us in these really wonderful ways, I can't express enough how grateful we are for all of you. So
yeah, because literally we could not do this. And I'm talking from a practical financial like standpoint, we could not do this without you guys. So no. This means a ton.
Everyone, thank you so much. Thank you to everyone who came on our tour and thank you to all of our listeners. And with that, and on that very lovely note, I think that finally concludes our two-part Paris recap, April.
Yes, but it's TBC, to be continued, Paris 2025.
Yes, we hope you will join us. So until next week, dress listeners, may you consider how clothes create connection next time you get dressed.
Dress listeners, if you are considering joining us in Paris in 2025, you can send us an email at hello@dressedhistory.com to join our mailing list, and you'll be the first to know when the dates are announced. Dressedhistory.com is also our website where you can find more information about our upcoming classes, tours, and anything else we have of our finely tailored sleeves next. And maybe Cass and I might have decided yesterday what our next class is going to be. And we're going to co-teach this next class. Yeah? You want to tease that?
Yeah, let's tease it. We are going to do the Golden Age of Haute Couture, a four-part class where I will give you the overviews of the period, introduce you to why this is such an exceptional period in the history of fashion, and then April's going to give you some designer deep dives.
Yeah, and know that we've briefly touched on some of these topics in some of our previous classes. We're conceptualizing those courses as like 101 courses. And now we're going to go even deeper and give you guys like maybe some 201 courses.
Yeah, exactly. But if you haven't taken those entry level classes, this will also get
it's
you
fine.
Up to speed.
Yeah, totally fine.
There's something for everyone. And also there's just so much beautiful imagery to look at. Most importantly,
yes.
Keep your eyes open for that soon because we'll be launching that probably within the next couple weeks. Dress listeners, always follow along on our Paris adventures on Instagram at dressed_podcast, where we will be posting images and reels to accompany this week's episodes. The content specifically connected to this week's episode, if you're listening to this in the future, you can find this content at #dressed516 and #dressed517.
Love dress but want to skip the ads? Consider subscribing to the ad-free version of the show for just $3 a month. You can check out the link in our show notes to do so. As always, thank you for your continued support. More Dressed coming your way on Friday. Dressed, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dressed Media.